Hello, this is Françoise Mathieu, and it is our webinar number 2, What are Compassion Fatigue and Burnout? So this is one of my favorite topics of all time. I became really interested in the concepts when I first heard about them, but interestingly, I didn't hear about them in school when I was doing my counseling training. It wasn't something that we really ever mentioned. Now, I went to school in the 90s. I graduated, I think, around 1996. And it turns out that we hadn't really talked about, I mean, burnout was something that was kind of discussed in the 80s a little bit, but compassion fatigue is a term I'd never heard of, and it really wasn't until 2001 that I came across something on the topic, and I thought, this totally makes sense. So if you're not familiar with what it means, let me give you a really quick definition. And I found that even high school kids, I sometimes do some assemblies, you know, for high school, grade 11, grade 12. When I explain it this way, they completely get it instantly. In fact, I did a TEDx talk a few months ago at Queens in Kingston. And if you're interested, it's on our website. I've just put the link there. And TED Talks are usually short, so it's about 17 minutes. And they wanted the conversation to be about what is the edge of compassion? What does it mean? So let me explain compassion fatigue really quickly and see if it makes sense for you. Have you ever had a friend who went through the world's longest ever breakup? And at the beginning, you were totally there for them. You're like, I got you. You call me anytime. Whatever you need. And would you agree that at some point, something shifted inside of you? Now, that might have been after the fourth time they went back to their partner or their, you know, loved one or whatever, their significant person they'd broken up with. It might be the first time. I mean, we can all agree that we all have kind of an inner reservoir, a different kind of tank about how much, you know, patience we have with other people's problems. And I think that's a personality feature, right? Some of us are more or less compassionate. But would you agree that something shifted between the moment where you were like, I got you, whatever you need, and this idea of kind of like, ugh, here we go again? And I really want to invite you to think about that, because that is basically a really quick explanation of what we mean when we talk about compassion fatigue at home and at work. We're referring to this kind of gradual emotional and physical exhaustion that we can develop towards other people in need. So that could be at home. So for example, I might have done a great job, you know, in my day job at working at the counseling service, and then maybe I would go home and someone in my family had a crisis and I'd think to myself, I got nothing. Or I would think, this crisis is not a crisis. Do you want to hear about a crisis? You know? And so what we started realizing in the field is that there was this shift that would happen inside of service providers of all kinds around certain issues, whether it was the same story over and over again from the same person, or maybe it was incredible similarity. Some of you have been around for a while. Would you agree that there are times where you have heard, you have met the identical same student with the identical same story, even though they're not the same person? Can you imagine how many first-year students I saw who had left home and were homesick? Thousands of them. And so the question is, when does that shift from no longer caring to, kind of to a point where it can start affecting the quality of the work and relationships that we have? So the question I was asking in the TEDx talk is basically, how do we care just the right amount? What is the sweet spot between caring too much? And that's another challenge we have, where I'm sure some of you have had this, where there's a story that really hitched a ride with you and you had a hard time letting it go. You'd think about that student at home, or, you know, you kind of, there's just something about that story that really kind of stayed, or not caring at all. And it's really this kind of tricky challenge and balance. When I was working at the counseling service, I used to have once in a while, quite often actually, students who were living all together, you know, they were housemates, and one of them, let's say, was dealing with a mental health issue, maybe depression, maybe an eating disorder. And I started noticing that the entire house became consumed with this person's issues to the point where it affected their own well-being and their studies. So we can agree that in that regard, they had become over-involved to the point where they had kind of lost perspective about, you know, what are the limits here? And can we agree that that's not, there's no perfect solution or answer to that? But also I saw the opposite, where people came to a place where they just didn't care anymore. And maybe, you know, someone's talking to you and in your head you're making a grocery list and they're crying and you're thinking, I should really take the chicken out of the freezer. And so we started realizing that compassion fatigue, which is sometimes also called empathic strain, is a result of being exposed to same stories or even the same person over and over again, and just not having as much compassion in our tank as we used to. Now, as I said before, not everyone is as compassionate like at the starting point. So my husband likes to joke that he doesn't have compassion fatigue because he doesn't have compassion, and he thinks it's hilarious. But he is not a touchy-feely, caring kind of guy. You know, he's a scientist, and he likes his people and, you know, his little world. But he's not out there with a Superman cape looking for, is there a child in the playground that needs my help? Whereas I tend to be, for a whole bunch of reasons, I think personality, my upbringing, I tend to be someone who gets over-involved unless I'm careful. So the original research on this topic is really interesting, came out of the early 1990s. And there were a bunch of psychologists like Dr. Charles Figley in Florida who started noticing that some service providers, such as mental health professionals, maybe some social workers, maybe some nurses, those were kind of the original groups that were studied, were demonstrating kind of what looked like signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, so some elements of, you know, PTSD-like symptoms, except that either they were not the full kind of PTSD symptom like you'd see maybe from someone coming back from the Vietnam War, but there were certain elements that looked like they had been affected by the work they were doing. And so scientists in the field started looking into this in the early 90s, and some really interesting work came out of this. Three groups that were studied at the time were cancer nurses, so nurses who were working in children's units. So this is pediatric cancer nurses. And as you can imagine, that's an incredibly challenging job. The mortality rate luckily has reduced, but we still, of course, lose children to cancer, which is unimaginable. But in the 70s and 80s, the death rate of children in cancer was extremely high. So we started noticing that these nurses were extremely emotionally distressed by their work, which I think everyone could understand. There was also research done at the time with child protection workers, so that might be people who worked for Children's Aid, and of course anyone who works with children who have been victimized, and by the way, that often would include you folks in terms of the work you do. We find that that has a high stress component, which of course we also understand. It's very morally and emotionally distressing to see vulnerable individuals be affected by certain circumstances. The other group that is really interesting and quite different were folks in the animal care community. So that might be vet techs, that might be veterinarians, it might be people working in an animal shelter. And they started noticing that those folks, because I think you'll understand that people who work in the animal care community are often, almost always, people who love animals, right? That's why you'd be attracted to that. But then what do you see? What's the nature of your day-to-day job? You're not working with happy, healthy animals. You're often working with animals who've experienced maybe even abuse, have been neglected and abandoned. And so those are kind of the original folks that were studied. And since then, we've done, people in my field have done research with a whole bunch of different professionals looking at what is it like to basically be a caring individual, and then how does watching people who are suffering in or in distress emotionally or physically, what does that do to us? And what we started noticing is people's compassion started eroding either towards the students or clients they were serving, or often towards their coworkers, which we'll talk more about in another webinar, or often in their personal life. And as I mentioned in the last webinar, I wrote a book called The Compassion Fatigue Workbook. And in the book, I start with an interview with this nurse who worked in a very busy community clinic in Toronto. And she tells the story of taking her grade 9 daughter to work, you know, for this thing that take your children to work day. And so her 14, 15-year-old daughter shadows her for the day. And they get home after work and they're having dinner. And she says to her daughter, you know, "So, honey, what did you think?" And her daughter says to her, "Mom, I found out something really interesting today." She said, "I realized that you're a heck of a lot nicer at work than you are at home." And every time I tell this story, someone in the room goes, "Oh, that feels so true." And so compassion fatigue is not necessarily a loss of compassion for the students you work for, although that may happen inevitably, but it might be a loss of patience, empathy, and compassion for their parents, for your colleagues, for the system, or maybe for people you have in your life. So that's a quick definition of, you know, in a nutshell, what is compassion fatigue. The second concept that was studied in those days was the concept of what we call secondary or indirect trauma. And secondary trauma refers to ways in which stuff we see and hear may change our view of the world and make us sometimes more anxious or more aware of, it's kind of a loss of innocence. So let me give you a couple of examples and I'll invite you to reflect on whether some of those have happened for you. I often show these pictures in my workshops, and the first one that you see there is a motorcycle. And sometimes I'll show this picture and maybe the audience is a very mixed group of professionals, and I'll say, "What's the first thing that comes to mind when you see this picture?" And some people will say, "Open road, freedom, wind in my hair, you know, I got one, I want one," all that. When I show this picture to trauma nurses, so I was showing this picture to nurses who work in a unit that's called the Acquired Brain Injury Unit, so they see a lot of head trauma, they immediately said, "Accident waiting to happen." Now, obviously, if you've had a tragic event or you yourself have been personally affected by someone who had a motorcycle accident, we would all understand that your view of the world has been changed by that. What we started noticing is that even if you had not had your own personal experience with something like that, if it was something that happened in the workplace or that you heard about through work, that may very well change your view of the world. Another example, I mean, I have millions of pictures I should show you. I could show you. Another one is a trampoline. You show this to a bunch of people and they say, "I have one, it's fun, I can't bounce on it because I'll hurt myself," or whatever. But if you show this to emergency room nurses and physicians, they will immediately say, you know, spinal injury or head injury. So at the end of the day, it's just a trampoline. But we started realizing that this work that we do changes our lens, our filter of the world, and that's not good or bad, but we do need to notice it. I am sure that every one of you, because of the work that you do, have had friends who had children who you knew for a fact had some type of exceptionality, or there was something that needed to be assessed, and they were in complete denial of that, right? Have you ever had that where you are looking at this kid and you think, "That kid, something's up. He needs accommodations. He needs to be assessed." And your friend who's not in this field at all would be like, "Oh, little Johnny's great," you know. And so it's not a good or bad thing. And sometimes it's good to have that knowledge base. But the question is, when does it go too far where it starts interfering with our ability to just enjoy ourselves in our private lives? An example I often give is if I walk into a restaurant, let's pretend I'm walking in with my partner and my brother. And my brother works for Cirque du Soleil. You know Cirque du Soleil, right? So my brother works for Cirque du Soleil. So he's basically in theater, if you think about it that way. And there's my husband, who's a scientist, who kind of lives in his own little head. And there's me. We walk into a restaurant together. I immediately notice relationships. I notice that couple's on a first date. That couple, that's their last date. That's not working. Who's that creepy guy in the back? That woman looks too young for him. You know, whatever. It's just my training. You might notice a whole bunch of other stuff. My brother, Cirque du Soleil, will notice whether there's cool sound and light and acoustics in the restaurant, and my husband may not notice any of those things. So it's kind of a quick way to think about how has this work changed the way you see the world. And these are not your own experiences of trauma, because those are direct trauma experiences. These are things that you've heard about through kids' stories that you've heard, debriefing that you've heard from each other, training that you've had. I was recently, and I promise I'm not going to slime you with details, but a couple of weeks ago, I was at a big child abuse conference, and one of the presenters, who's an expert in child pornography, described a story that was so graphic that although I have never done that work, that story stayed with me. So what he did, I'm not criticizing, although, what he did is he kind of slimed us all with a graphic story of something terrible happening to a child. And although that's never happened to me or I haven't seen that before, it stayed in my head. So that's a quick definition of indirect trauma or secondary trauma. And we just need to notice those things. So here's how we're working through this in our trainings. We started realizing that it's not cut and dried, and it's not necessarily always the difficult stories that bother us the most. I work with a lot of prison folks, right? I work with a lot of parole officers, and a lot of them say to me, oh my goodness, I have heard so many stories. Those don't even bother me. I can eat a sandwich while watching a crime scene photo. So we started realizing that it's not necessarily just the trauma. It's more complicated than that. So as an activity, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to describe these various features, and I'm going to invite you personally to reflect on which ones of these are true for you. And if you have this, basically if you were using this as a little handout, you could literally color in each one, you know, green being that you're in a good place with this piece, yellow being that you've got kind of warning signs, and red being like this is a really big one for you. So let me walk you through these. And what we found is this is a much more useful tool for all of us in the field to kind of assess what needs attention. So number one, personal circumstances. Can we agree that we've all got stuff? We've all got challenges. And because I'm a therapist, I meet a lot of people, right? I meet people all the time, and I will talk to them in my practice when I had a practice in the community. And I could have literally, in my practice, in a day, have had the guy who works at Loblaws, and the guy who works at Shoppers, and the woman who works in the bank. And, I saw everybody. So we can all agree we've got stuff. And sometimes those personal circumstances can really contribute to our level of stress. If you have a loved one who's going through cancer treatment or an illness or a mental health challenge, or maybe you yourself have children with exceptionalities. My daughter has full-blown attention deficit disorder. And so, she's done well, but that has been a daily challenge where as I finish my day as a caregiver professionally, I would go home and have to start again. So what's your stuff? Are you struggling with an addiction? Are you struggling with your own past challenges? And, I think those are very common, and there's a lot of secrecy or stigma around them, and I understand that. But the truth is that our personal stuff has an impact on how we deal with our work. So what's going on for you is the question there. The next one is called work-related grief and loss. And that refers to things that happen in the workplace that upset you and that cause a certain amount of grief. Now, of course, a big example would be a tragic event. That's basically obvious that, we lose a child, we lose a colleague. I mean, those are the big ones. But there's a lot of subtle ways in which we experience work-related grief and loss. A colleague retires. That's a loss. A colleague is fired, and you never find out why. You work in a workplace that's been merged, like your school. My son's school is slated for closure in a year, and, we're being put into another school with a bunch of other schools and so on. That's a loss. So those are all kind of things that might happen for you, and has this been part of the stressors in the last little while. As I mentioned before, direct exposure is you are in the middle of it, you are assaulted, you witness an assault. You know, those are direct trauma. The secondary trauma is all the stuff you hear from the kids, from each other, from trainings, from the media. I remember at some point talking to some kids, this is a few years ago, so I'm dating myself, but talking to some kids who had seen or read the book or seen the movie Lovely Bones. And some of you may have seen or read that movie or read that book. It's a very disturbing account of a young woman, a young teen, like she's about 14, I think, or 15, and I won't tell you what happens, but awful things happen, and she dies, and it's very, very detailed. And a lot of kids I talked to said that they had developed secondary trauma as a result of seeing that. They were afraid. They had nightmares. So there's lots of ways in which we can develop that, and it's not unusual in the work that we do, but what we need to notice is when it's becoming a problem, when you are really haunted by a story, or when it starts affecting the way you carry on your life in a way that's a little bit too extreme. So, excuse me, it's normal that I'm, because I've done so much work in terms of date rape, because of working at colleges and universities, it's okay for me to have a conversation with my daughter as she goes away to college about those things. But if I become paranoid and, you know, monitor everything she does all the time, that's a sign that maybe it's gone too far. The next one, which I just discussed, is compassion fatigue. So the wear, the erosion of your ability to care for other people. The second to last one, I think, is really important, and we call it systems failure. Now, the polite term for this, and I'm sure you've experienced it before, is, you know, the BS. Situations where, and wherever you work, situations where rules, regulations, laws, procedures conflict with what you believe is right. Now, I think every person I've ever talked to has experienced a certain amount of frustration or large frustration around systems failures. For example, when I worked at the University Counseling Service, we had very limited resources, so we could only see clients for X amount of sessions. And sometimes, once that was over, they had nowhere to go. They may not have had the financial resources to get more therapy. They may not have had, you know, and so those are examples in which I felt incredibly frustrated because I was experiencing what we call moral distress. And moral distress refers to situations where what you believe is the right thing to do is not happening because rules, regulations conflict with it. I could give you a million examples of this, and what I encourage you to do, I think all of us could easily, you know, get really wedged into this place and have a big old bitch fest about the things that make us mad. And I'm not minimizing that, but I started realizing at some point, and that's for another webinar, that I needed to find a way to deal with my anger around rules, regulations I disagreed with, because if I let it get to me, I was going to have to either leave or I was going to become an unethical provider. So let me give you an example, and I've heard so many. I was talking to refugee judges, and they talked about situations where someone who was coming to put in a claim didn't fill out the right paperwork, and so now they're not eligible and they're going to be deported, right? Another example would be a child aging out of the system. Maybe they're a Crown ward and now they're a certain age and now we're like, good luck, little buddy. You know, there's millions of examples of that. And although we cannot fix the systems we work in necessarily, we do need to find a way to navigate that, because otherwise, and I'm sure some of you have experienced this, and I know I left the university after 7 years because I was mad all the time. I was mad at the receptionist. She was too friendly, and I was stressed. And she'd, you know, I'd come into work, and she'd be like, good morning, and I didn't feel like that. I felt mad at the lack of resources. I just realized at some point that my biggest challenge was not losing compassion for my clients. My biggest challenge was that I was becoming a really cynical, grumpy member of staff, and I needed to not do that. That didn't work for me. That's not what I want to do. I don't want to be in this field because I'm mad all the time. And I also needed to pick my battles, but that's a whole other conversation. So the final element is burnout. And burnout has to do with your working conditions. So burnout has to do with your hours, your pay, your recognition, who you immediately report to. Do you have access to a good supervisor? And I'm sure some of you have moved in the same field. So maybe you're an EA and you moved from one school to another, and you went from a not ideal environment to a really supportive environment, and all of a sudden you said, you know, the hard stories are manageable because I have support. So that's a really interesting factor, and we know that people can burn out in any occupation, but what really makes a difference is when we go to a place where we feel valued and recognized. And there's been some really interesting research suggesting that what matters the most in the workplace is who you immediately report to as opposed to where you work. So as I mentioned to you in the webinar, the prior webinar, I've worked in the correctional system many, many times, and I think we can all agree that the prison system is one of the most toxic work environment ever. They will tell you that. You know, correctional officers will say that. And what we'll find is that what matters the most is who is their supervisor. If you've got a good supervisor, if that person is fair, if they're flexible, if they trust you, that has a tremendous impact, even though they work in what are called high-stress, high-trauma-exposed environments. So there's some really interesting work that was done on this topic by my friend and colleague Stéphane Grenier. You may not have heard of Stéphane, but I'm sure you've heard of some of what he's done. Stéphane was in the Canadian military, and he was in Rwanda, was a witness to the genocide. In fact, he's just published a book called After the War just a couple of months ago. And Stéphane was instrumental in, and he developed operational stress injury and PTSD as a result. And he was involved with the Mental Health Commission in making recommendations to change the way that we do this really challenging work. And some of you may have seen some information called the Road to Mental Readiness, where they're kind of trying to look at how do we support staff who do some really difficult, you know, high stress, high trauma exposed work, how do we protect them? And one of the quick things I wanted to mention to you before I run out of time is that one of the things that Stéphane talks about, so they call it operational stress injury, meaning that people go out to combat, and some of them develop PTSD, but some of them develop also other elements that are actually being found to be sometimes even more powerful. Many of you know Romeo Dallaire, who was the general there, and what Romeo Dallaire talks about in his books is that what traumatized him the most was actually what he called a moral injury. He was, of course, horrified by what he saw, but he was particularly horrified by his inability to do anything, to change it, and by the fact that people above him, he perceived, did not do anything to help and prevent this from happening. The final piece I wanted to mention about Stéphane's model is the second one here, you'll see fatigue. And I really like this concept where what we're realizing, and I like the term that he has there, a wear and tear. I think that in our jobs, I think if I was talking, you know, to you face-to-face or I was in your schools, can we all agree that some of the work we do is just exhausting? We're on our feet all the time. Many of you have very little breaks, very little time to just take a rest, have a drink, have water, some snacks. So some of the work, and by the way, we see this also very frequently in nurses. As many of you know, and maybe some of you are nurses or were nurses in the past, or you have friends who were, just the daily grind of being on your feet, of being on the go. And so some of what we're experiencing is sheer wear and tear. And the reason I'm presenting this to you is, in my opinion, the best first strategy is for all of us individually to decide which areas are the most challenging to you. Now, you may say all of them, which is fair, but on a scale of 1 to 5, which one is a 5? Like you're in the red zone, this needs attention. And this becomes a way for all of us to figure out where we're going to, there's an expression that says dig where the ground is soft. Where are you going to start? Now, personally, I left the university because the systems failure piece was getting to me. I was just mad all the time. I needed to leave. I stayed in trauma work. I, in fact, started seeing more and more soldiers who were coming back from combat zone, and I loved my job. And I started realizing that it wasn't the trauma that had gotten to me. It was a combination of lack of support in terms of resources and also lack of training. So that's for another time. I'll tell you more about that later. But this is your reflection activity for today. And if you have a chance to talk about this with someone else that you feel comfortable doing so, have a chat. You know, let's go through those circles and have a think about what's your number one challenge, and then we can start kind of hammering out some strategies. Again, a reminder, you have any questions, please do not hesitate to get in touch with us, and I'll see you on the third webinar.